Welcome to the Common Sense Spirituality Show, the show that takes the mystery out of spirituality with your host, David Gagan, engineer, science director, scholarly researcher of life's mysteries, and author of The Endless Journey.
Welcome to the Common Sense Spirituality Show. I'm host Dave Gagan, and today's show is titled Extrasensory Perception. Please note that all the chat room questions will be answered in the chat room on next week's show, as well as posted on my website, which is davidgagan.com, within a day or so of the show. I have been told that some of you are not aware that you can easily access these answers on my website, so I encourage you to visit the site where you can also ask additional questions, even about other shows. You can also listen to any previous show on iHeartRadio at iHeart.com by searching for either David Gagan or Common Sense Spirituality. We encourage and welcome your questions. Today's guest is Russell Targ, a physicist, author, a pioneer in the development of laser and laser applications, and a co-founder of the program he established in the 1970s and 1980s at the Stanford Research Institute, often referred to as SRI, to investigate psychic abilities. SRI is a research and development think tank in Menlo Park, California. Mr. Targ's work in this psychic area has been published in Nature, the Proceedings of the Institute of Electronic and Electrical Engineers, and the Proceedings of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. In addition, numerous books have been written by participants in this research. Mr. Targ has a bachelor's degree in physics from Queens College and did graduate work in physics at Columbia University. He has received two NASA awards for inventions and contributions to lasers and laser communications. In 1983 and 1984, he accepted invitations to present remote viewing demonstrations and to address the USSR Academy of Science on this research. He is author or co-author of seven books dealing with the scientific investigation of psychic abilities and Buddhist approaches to the transformation of consciousness, including Mind Research, Scientists Look at Psychic Ability, Miracles of Mind, Exploring Non-Local Consciousness and Spiritual Healing, and Limitless Mind, A Guide to Remote Viewing and Transformation of Consciousness. Mr. Targ's most recent book is The Reality of ESP, which is the topic I want to talk to him about today. Russell Targ, welcome to the show, Russell. Great to have you here.
Well, I'm happy to be with you.
Hey, let's start out for our listeners nice and, well, I don't know if it's easy or not, but I guess it's easy. What's ESP? What is extrasensory perception?
Well, the kind of ESP I'm talking about is called remote viewing, which is very simple. It allows a person to quiet their mind and describe and experience what's going on in a distant place. And this has been written about since biblical times and the Greeks and the Buddhists. The idea that you can quiet your mind and find your car keys, find a parking place, successfully invest in the stock market, and you can find out who you really are. So I was teaching people how to do remote viewing for 10 years, working for the CIA and Army Intelligence at Stanford. Now, I know this doesn't sound like a spiritual approach, but if you spend 10 years sitting in the dark, you have all sorts of very interesting experiences. And what becomes clear is that there is more to who we are than what you see in the mirror in the morning.
Yeah,
what you see in the mirror in the morning is just a source of suffering. Who you really are is a timeless awareness that has been written about in spiritual teaching since the time of Christ or before. So remote viewing and the ESP I'm talking about is the ability you have to see into the distance, see into the future, just by quieting your mind.
Now you did this at Stanford Research Institute. How did you get involved in this? I mean, you know, you were trained as a as a physicist, and obviously did a lot of work in lasers, which doesn't seem to have an awful lot to do with remote viewing. How'd you get involved?
Well, I was interested in magic since I was a child, as my vision is very poor. So it's natural for a person with very bad vision to be interested in any kind of other perception beside visual perception. So I was interested in magic and psychic abilities since I was a little kid. I used to hang out in the magic shops on 42nd Street in New York. And I became a pretty proficient stage magician, standing on the stage, fooling adults, pretending to read minds. And what became clear to me as a teenager, that some of what I would pick up from the audience was genuine. Most of what I did was a trick of one kind of another, mental magic. But sometime when I'd be standing on the stage with the lights in my eyes, I would really get an impression of what someone in the audience was thinking. And I let stage magic go as a young scientist and began to read about parapsychology research and the work that was being done in America and abroad. Now, it was clear to me you can't make a living doing ESP research, or it's very hard. So I pursued my other interest, which was optics. Optics is also natural for a person with bad vision to be interested in. And in long time ago, late 1950s, I got involved in the development of the laser. So I was really a laser pioneer for two decades before I got professionally involved in ESP. But I was a lifetime interest, and by the 1970s, I was then well enough known to NASA and to the CIA, so I could come and say, I got something new for you. It's not a laser, but it's something you'll be interested in. How about letting me teach people how to do psychic abilities? It might be useful during the Cold War. And what I had was an ESP teaching machine, so an electronic gadget that gives you feedback and reinforcement. When you make a correct answer, it rings a bell and shows you a picture. It allows you to pass if you don't have that special feeling. So the idea that I had, and the gadget that I brought to a NASA conference, is something that would give you feedback when you push the right button. And it just happened that Wernher von Braun was there, and he did very well on my machine. No doubt that he sent bombs down on the English, but he was also a very intuitive, a psychic-minded person. And he told the director of NASA, who was there, maybe you should give these guys some money. So in 1972, I was able to go to NASA with I was able to go to Stanford Research Institute with an administrator from NASA and tell them that we promised not to create any problem. NASA will give us some money to start a program. And that ESP game is now available to you at no charge. I put it on the internet. It's called ESP Trainer, and is a Apple application. You can just download that free and learn to develop your own psychic abilities.
Yeah, that's amazing. Now, before we get into remote viewing and a lot of the things that you came up with, which I'm going to do very shortly, you know, in your book, The Reality of ESP, you cite a large number of well-documented and scientifically controlled experiments, which clearly show that ESP phenomena is far more likely to be true than not. Science buys into far more speculative concepts like the Big Bang Theory and dark energy and dark matter. Why don't scientists accept the ESP data?
Well, we have a problem with science. There are a number of reasons. First of all, ESP is not as reliably repeatable as a physics experiment. If I have a lamp on my desk, that lamp comes on every single time I throw the switch. So there's no doubt that electricity makes the light go on. But with ESP in the laboratory, although most of the time my viewer that I'm working with can describe where somebody is hiding, some of the time they're not successful. And it's that kind of intermittent performance that makes people dubious. Now, we got some credibility in 1980s when we were using psychic ability to forecast silver futures. And every week we made a forecast for whether silver would go up or down, up a little, down a little, up a lot, down a lot. And our 9 forecasts were all correct. So we did this silver forecasting 9 times in a row, and we made $120,000. And that got a great deal of credibility. We were in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and we thought that we had the golden goose. But the thing that changed, you see, the Buddhist idea is that you can't step 2 times in the same river because the river has gone by you and the river is not the same anymore. Similarly, we did this experiment in 1982. In a sense, we were doing it for science. Can you harness the psychic ability that we're doing and make money with it? And the answer is yes, we did that. Following year, we were not successful. So although the whole world was very interested in us in 82, by 83, they said, even though what you did was odds of 1,000,000 to 1, maybe it's not real because it didn't work the following year. And what I believe is there's a lot of interest in this now. There's something called the International Remote Viewing Association, which meets every year, and it's comprised mainly of retired Army people, believe it or not. We taught a lot of people in Army intelligence how to do remote viewing, and that psychic Army Corps paralleled us for another 15 years. And when they retired from the Army, so we have a lot of ex-majors and colonels standing on the stage talking about very spiritual-sounding things, which is not, they're not wearing the uniform, but we know who they are. And a lot of people are making money forecasting things psychically. So my opinion is that we will have much more acceptance for psychic abilities next time some group of people make $1,000,000 in their laboratory. And quite a few people have now made hundreds of thousands of dollars. That if you go to Google and search for remote viewing, there's 500,000 pages dealing with books and teachers who want to show you about remote viewing. So although physical science hadn't agreed with us yet, there's a great deal of general interest in psychic abilities.
Okay. Remote viewing. Let's talk about it. Explain, what is remote viewing? It's like clairvoyance, I guess. But
yeah, remote viewing is like clairvoyance. Clairvoyance was described in the 1800s, and we simply didn't want to talk about out-of-body experience, clairvoyance. We didn't want to scare away our CIA, NASA customers talking about something that sounded like airy-fairy 19th century mysticism. And it was really Ingo Swann, a New York artist and psychic, who gave us the name remote viewing. Swann was the first person we had who was confident of his ability to describe what's in the distance. My partner, Hal Puthoff, and I were both laser people, laser scientists. And we would do experiments where we would ask Swan to look in the next room and see if the laser light is turned on or see what's on the blackboard. And he would tell us more than once, if I want to see what's in the next room, I'll open the door. If I want to see what's in the envelope, I'll open the envelope. I'm able to quiet my mind and describe anything on the planet. You're wasting my time. It's a trivialization of my abilities to look into the next room. And he was the one who broadened our wings and gave us the inspiration to teach people to quiet their mind, close their eyes, and learn to separate the psychic signal from their mental noise. Learn what it feels like when you're doing something psychic. So what remote viewing is, you could say everyone has the experience, perhaps, of having a dream. In the next day, some aspect of that dream comes true. You have a dream about some distant relative who you haven't seen, and the next day you get a letter, she calls you up. So the idea of precognition is really the most common kind of psychic ability. Even though you're looking into the future, many, many people have experience with a dream that comes true the next day. In remote viewing, we try and help people to harness that psychic aspect of themselves. So, for example, the experiment we did that worked the very best is I would have my partner, Hal, sent off to hide someplace in the San Francisco Bay Area, some random location that I didn't know about. And I would sit with the psychic of the day, could be an person who's part of our program, could be an Army officer, could be the Undersecretary of Defense. We'd work with all kinds of people, and I was the kind of psychic travel agent. I would sit with him and say, okay, you've met Hal. He's off with your adjutant now, and they've gone to hide someplace. I want you to quiet your mind and tell me about the surprising images that come into your awareness. We're going to take you to this place in a little while, but right now, Hal and your buddy are hiding somewhere. Tell me about the surprising things that come into your awareness. And with those magic words, they will tell me about the surprise that comes into their awareness. For example, if they say, oh, I know where they are. They're at Macy's department store. I was there in the shopping center. And I would say, no, don't tell me about Macy's. That's an analytic description. Macy's didn't come into your mind. Tell me what came into your mind that makes you say Macy's. So even though I have no idea where they are, I do know what psychic ability sounds like. I know what remote viewing sounds like. So I can guide a person away from what we think of as mental noise, and I can guide them toward the psychic signal. And people learn to be pretty good at that. In my book, The Reality of ESP, I describe in detail how you can work with another person, and both of you can learn to separate the psychic signal from the mental noise and incorporate psychic abilities into your life.
Some of the experiments you did were amazing, and you were working with some pretty serious folks. I mean, you know, the CIA and NASA and the Army and Air Force intelligence organizations, you know, you spent a lot of years with them, and I'm sure they funded the research pretty fully. They clearly were getting results, and you had some.
Well, one of the very nice results, like the sort of an old result that just got corroborated, the CIA knew that a Russian bomber, reconnaissance bomber, had crashed in Africa. And we could not find it because it was in the jungle. And we knew with the problem, this was the early 80s. We knew that this plane had gone down, and we couldn't find it with satellite photography because it was in the jungle. So CIA came to us explicitly. Here's a picture of this bomber, this backfire bomber, Russian plane. We know just what it looks like. And it crashed someplace in North Africa. We've been looking for it for a week, and we can't find anything. Can you help us? And we had a fellow and a woman working on this, and the guy drew a very good picture of it with the tail popping out of the river. And the woman was given a overall map of the area, and she drew a little circle. And the CIA, based on our past experience, We didn't give them a lot. We just said, here it is, but we couldn't prove it. They launched a helicopter into that region of near Zaire, and they landed in the circle, and within a mile they found the bomber. And this story is now told, so you don't have to believe me. Jimmy Carter has just written a biography of his first 90 years, and he said the most remarkable thing that happened during his presidency is the CIA was trying to find this downed Russian bomber nothing would work. Satellites didn't work. But we called some psychics in California, and they told us just where it was. And I wrote, said, thank you, Mr. President.
That's an amazing story.
So you can't have a better testimonial than that.
Yeah, I agree. How does it work? How does the psychic know where this is? Does his mind go there and he looks around, or do we have any idea how it works?
Well, some of us have an idea. All the physicists who are trying to model this have the idea that there's additional dimensions available. And my model is similarly inclined. We know that there are three spatial dimensions, sort of an X, Y, and Z, north, south, east, west, and up and down, the three familiar dimensions, and there's a time dimension. Now, if you remember your high school math, there are complex numbers also, where you have x squared plus iy squared equals something. And the complex number is just another aspect of the real number. So many people, including Einstein, was involved with the idea that not only do you have four familiar dimensions, but each of those dimensions might have a complex part. I won't go into what that is now.
Right.
So you have the ability to add dimensions, and you can travel through space-time and find a path through this now eight-dimension space-time. You have eight dimensions because you got the familiar four dimensions. Tell me that's okay. You understand,
right,
about the familiar four dimensions?
Oh, yeah.
Now, each of those four dimensions has a real part and an imaginary part. And we don't have to go into what that means right now. But what it means is that if you add a real part and an imaginary part, it's possible for them to add to zero. And what this model allows you to do is you can travel through space-time from where I am to you, where you are, through this complex space-time, and there's no distance at all. If we go by railroad train, it's 3,000 miles. But if we go through space-time, there's a way of doing that, so there's no distance. And the Buddhists talked about this 1,200 years ago. They said, for consciousness, there's no separation. So it's not that I have to leap from here where I am in Palo Alto, California, to where you are. You're on the East Coast, is that right?
Yeah, outside of Boston.
So I don't have to crawl over those 3,000 miles. My consciousness is in the same space as you are. The idea is that there's no separation. And the reason we think that that's a good model is that it's no harder to describe what you're doing in Boston than it is to describe what's across the street here in Palo Alto. So it's no hard. People doing ESP research disagree about lots of things because we don't know the answer. But I'm telling you, they model. But what we do know is that it's no harder to look 3,000 miles to Boston or 6,000 miles to Moscow than it is to look across the street or describe what's in the box. So a physicist would say this is a non-local ability. That is, in non-local space-time, which is increasingly popular in modern physics, the idea of non-locality, and David Bohm talks about quantum interconnectedness.
Right.
The idea that the physics will be there before anybody. Physicists will get there before the psychologists. Because in physics, we now know that there is surprising connectivity beyond what you see on the table in front of you. So the way you're able to see from here to Boston is that there is no separation for consciousness.
Okay.
For example, I could I just picked up an interesting object on my table in front of me. And I could ask you, don't tell me what I have, but just tell me what surprising image pops into your awareness. What kind of shape or form suddenly
spherical.
Shows up?
Spherical.
You don't have to, what?
Spherical. That's what shows up. A spherical.
That's fine. Tell me about it.
It's made of glass. It's,
yes. Okay. Why don't we stop there? Stop on a win. Because I know I just sprung that on you.
I
have is a large, very thick magnifying glass.
Hmm.
And I'm looking through it, and of course it looks spherical. So this thing is 4 inches in diameter and about 2 inches thick. And it's just a big, fat, spherical piece of glass. It's not quite spherical, of course. But it looks spherical. Looks like a glass paperweight.
I'll tell you, that
you
is very
know exactly what a glass. You know what a glass paperweight looks like.
I do indeed. We're talking with Russell Targ, the author of The Reality of ESP.
I would ask you, you've been asking me all sorts of tough questions. So I would say, well, that's a very, very good job. What I had is essentially a glass paperweight in front of me. And you said you see something made of glass and it's spherical. I said, David, how did you do that?
And I have no idea.
It
wasn't hard. But I have no idea how I did that.
So what we're teaching, the whole story in my new book, Reality of ESP, is that psychic abilities are natural. Everybody can do it to a greater or lesser degree. You don't have to pay thousands of dollars and eat porridge at the feet of your guru. You just need somebody to guide you, ask you the right questions, and the psychic ability will manifest. Even a radio host can do it.
Yeah. So anybody can do it then.
That's really well done. Are you surprised?
I am very surprised. Extremely surprised. And I read your book, and I'm still surprised. But I'll tell you what else surprised me is, and your point of distance is well taken on it. Is that one of your examples was you had you discovered a ring around Jupiter that they
not
didn't,
me
they,
Ingo Swann did.
Okay, but
great,
you're probably
great psychic Ingo Swann.
It's amazing. Tell the listeners a little bit about that one.
Well, we had a contract with NASA to teach people how to get in touch with their psychic abilities, and that led to the ESP teaching machine that's available to you, my ESP trainer. And they said, you know, we're sending a Pioneer spacecraft to Jupiter in just a few days. Can you tell us anything that we'll find on Jupiter that's a surprise? We know there's a big red spot there. Do you know anything else? And Ingo said, well, let me close my eyes here. And he just rocked back in his desk chair. He said, you know, I see that there's a circle there. It's like a bright circle with crystals. There's a circular ring right around Jupiter, just one of them. It's not like Saturn, but I see this very bright ring. And 6 months later, the Pioneer spacecraft got there, and we had photographs of the ring around Saturn. And Ingo had no problem instantaneously sending his awareness off 500 million miles away to describe what was there. So in a certain sense, I would say the ring around Jupiter was in his mind all the time, or his mind filled all of space, or we don't know how to properly describe space, but his non-local awareness included the ring around Jupiter, and we had two NASA scientists standing in my office. It took him no time. He just sat down, closed his eyes, and said, "Jupiter, I can do that." And he just told us about the ring. And I show the ring. I show his narrative and the pictures he drew, and I show NASA's photograph of the ring in their report on the experiment.
Yeah, it's very interesting. It kind of blew me away when I saw that. A few minutes ago, you talked about precognition. And then you gave an example of it about 9/11. Could you explain, make sure everybody understands what precognition is, and then talk about that example that you came up with.
Well, let's see. I did not have a 9/11 example.
The 30% load factor on the airplane today.
Yes. I'd forgotten about that. Yeah, this is just something that I observed. This was not a precognition of somebody in my laboratory, but I was actually in Italy. I was at a peace conference on the day of 9/11, so I psychically flew out of America on September 12th, on September 10th rather than September 11th. So the day of the 9/11 terrorist attack, I was in a big peace conference, and it took me a while, since everything was in Italian, it took me a while to figure out what was going on. So I picked up the New York Times International edition the next day to read about it. And I had, at that point, I had already left SRI, and I was working for Lockheed doing airplane safety things with lasers, looking for wind shear and air turbulence. So I had become an airplane safety guy with lasers at that period in my life. So I was very conversant with safety issues.
Okay.
So as I looked in the International Times, what I saw is that each of these four planes had about 30% of the people that it could normally carry. As you said, the load factor was about 30%. So a big 737 that can carry 150 people, there are only 50 people in it. And a DC-10 that could carry 200 people had less than 100 people. And each of those four planes, in the published data, each of the four planes was missing two-thirds of the people who would normally be on it. So it's as though, even though this was an ordinary Tuesday morning, wasn't raining, there's no known problem, thousands of people decided not to fly. They canceled their reservations. They didn't show up. So it's as though thousands of people knew that there was some hazard in their future. And as a result of that, you had many, many fewer people killed than would have otherwise been killed.
Yeah.
So on the plane, if you had 200 people, you had like 600 people killed on the airplanes themselves. On an ordinary day, those planes would be packed and you'd have killed 1,500 people. And a similar thing was observed years before. Observation was made on the East Coast. William Cox at the J.B. Ryan Laboratory noticed that on days when trains were derailed, which was not such an uncommon thing 50 years ago, the trains that were derailed had many fewer people on them, and in some cases a lot fewer, like 20% of the people. He observed, in looking at 50 train wrecks on the East Coast, that they had hugely fewer people than the trains that did not wreck. And he normalized that for day of the week and the weather. So the evidence is pretty good that people wake up in the morning and say, "I don't feel good about my trip," and I think I'm not going to take it.
Now, how does precognition work? Is that a forecast? I mean, can you, you know,
exactly a forecast.
Okay.
It's a forecast, but it can be an unintentional forecast. When we were sitting down forecasting whether silver would go up or down, that was a deliberate experiment. You can't say, what's the price of silver going to be today? Because psychic functioning is not an analytical ability. You can't read the numbers on the big board. That would be very nice if I could say, close your eyes and tell me what numbers are on the big board of the commodity exchange. Nobody can do that. But I can tell you, what we did is we had our friendly stockbroker, each Monday, he would look around his office and choose four different objects. Let's say a teddy bear, a coffee cup, a whiskey bottle, and a book. And he would just label one of those up a lot, up a little, down a lot, down a little. And I would then sit with my psychic and say, John's got four objects and I don't know what they are, but on Friday, I'm going to show you some interesting object that you wouldn't expect to be hand. He will send me or bring me the object that corresponds with silver did. For example, if we had the champagne bottle means that silver went up a lot, and it did go up a lot, he would then send me the champagne bottle. So I would say, close your eyes and tell me what you experience me handing you on Friday. So here we'll be here right here on Friday. I'm going to put something in your hand. Tell me what that feels like. And he could say it feels like a teddy bear, or it feels like a cylindrical bottle, or it feels like a book. And depending what he said, I would then call the broker and say, my guy described a tall bottle. It looks like a wine bottle. And he'd say, well, that's one of my objects. What does it mean? I would ask him. And he would say, well, that's a champagne bottle. That means up a lot. So based on that, we would buy silver. And we call that associative remote viewing. It's a way of making an association between something that exists in the world and what you're going to see at a later time, rather than have you try and do a symbolic guess like, is silver going up this week and how much? That's basically an impossible task. But because it's entirely symbolic. But if I ask you something straightforward and say, David, here we are, and I'm going to hand you an interesting object on Friday. I'm going to come right into your office and put this thing in your hand. What do you experience? That is not a hard task to do, even though it's next week or next Friday.
Now, and that's because of the probability of the future. It's not a guarantee. It's a probability. And the trouble with the future, of course, is you have free will and people can make other decisions. But is that how you see it working?
I think you don't have as much free will as you would as you believe, because these precognition experiments work very well. They work as well as ordinary remote viewing. In fact, when I went to Russia and I was doing demonstrations for the Soviet Academy of Science, my daughter Elizabeth is a Russian speaker, so we did a number of experiments, four demos for the Academy of Science with a Russian psychic, and we did precognition experiments because our impression is that instead of being harder, for certain reasons, precognition is actually easier to do, and we think it's easier for psychological reasons. May not be true anymore, but if I ask a experienced psychic, see, I got a Russian psychic who's used to doing whatever it was she did, And my idea was, if I give her something so impossible to do, I say, we'll take work from California. We'll take responsibility for this. In 2 hours, my friend is going to be someplace in California. Tell me what you see. In a certain sense, she psychologically gives up. Like, that totally doesn't make any sense. I don't know anything about California. How can I describe this thing in the future? And our theory is that she will then do what we tell her to do about quieting her mind and telling us this and that. So we think that precognition is just as easy as remote viewing, because you can move through space and time just as easily as you can move through space. Now, that means that there's some, you have the experience of free will, but we think the evidence is that you don't have as much free will as you think you have.
Because we're so programmed. Because we're so programmed to react to the world as we do.
Well, as a scientist, I believe in causality. I think that I have many, many objects on my desk here. And as I was chatting with you, I just grabbed my big magnifier. Somebody standing behind me might have guessed, because the magnifier is the most, in a certain sense, although I have a lot of interesting things on my desk, in a certain sense, the big magnifier is an attractive object. So I think that I just grabbed what was nearby. The skeptic would have said, well, I would have chosen the magnifier also, but you didn't know that.
Right. I didn't know what was on your desk. Right.
So I believe in causality. So you have a little less free will than you think you have. But what I would say is that the extent to which you're aware of your psychic ability and you're aware of the psychic images, the more control you have. For example, in spite of my bad vision, I ride a motorcycle. And I'm still alive after 35 years of riding the motorcycle.
It's a miracle in itself.
That's right. And I've had the experience... Well, one of which I write about because it was so clear. I was riding. I don't ride on the freeway, but I ride on busy avenues. And I had the feeling one day that I was zipping to work from my home that what would I do if I come around this corner and there was a board there? I mean, I'm doing 30 miles an hour. I'm just a little soft-shelled animal on a motorcycle. If there was a board in the road, that would upset me. I'd go flying. And as I was thinking about that, I started going slower and slower and slower. And I came around the corner, the 2x4 in the road, crossing the whole roadway. But by that point, I was going slow enough so I could just bump over it. So I would say that there was an accident waiting for me in the future. And because I'm sort of attuned to funny things showing up in my awareness, I didn't have to have that accident.
Yeah, it's amazing. We're running out of time, and I know our listeners would like a short description of how they would do this themselves, remote view themselves. Now, I know you have it in the book, and people can go to the book and look at it, but could you do it, you know, just give a quick overview of how you teach somebody to remote view.
Well, first thing I would say is find a friend, or at least somebody who you trust, who won't make fun of you. Then find a partner to work with, and then ask that partner to come to your place with an object in the bag, and just choose one object to begin with. So she will bring you something in a grocery bag, put it on the floor next to the table, say, hi, David, I've brought you an interesting object. Here's a big piece of paper. I want you to quiet your mind and make a little sketch of the surprising thing that shows up in your awareness. Don't guess what. Don't try and guess what it is. Don't name it. I know what it is. I can visualize it. I'm going to show it to you in a few minutes. Just tell me what surprising shape and form shows up in your awareness. And you'll take your pencil and make a drawing, not of the object, but you're making a drawing of the surprising thing that shows up in your awareness. So I tell people, you can't do this wrong. You know what's in your mind. I just want you to quiet your mind, take a couple of deep breaths, and make a drawing of the surprising thing that shows up. And after you're done with that, she could then lead you to take another piece of paper. And does anything else come to view? Are there any colors? Can you tell me about the shape, the weight of this? Imagine holding it in your hand. What kind of weight do you feel? What does the material feel like? What colors come to view? Does it have any special odor? And then she'll show you the object.
Okay.
And you learn to separate your guess about what you bring from what you experience. And then on subsequent days, she'll bring two or three objects in two or three bags, and then she will randomly mix them up and choose one, because ideally you don't want your interviewer to know the answer, because she's going to tend to lead you. For your first trial, it's okay if she leads you, because we just want you to get the feeling of that. But you don't want to train yourself to think that your psychic abilities are really brought to you by the mind of your interviewer. You want to be free of your interviewer, but your interviewer can help you do this.
Yeah, that's you're saying that virtually anybody can be trained to do this to some level.
Anybody can be trained to do it somewhat. Ingo Swann, Pat Price, some of the great people. It's like a musical ability. That is, anybody can learn to play the piano. In the 1930s, every middle-class house in America had a piano, and somebody was reading music and playing songs. And in a society where there was no piano playing, that would seem quite miraculous. I mean, look, the whole society is able to play 88 keys and music comes out. But that won't get you to Carnegie Hall.
Right. we're rapidly running out of time. You have done an amazing amount of fascinating work at SRI and later. And you know, the world, I'm convinced, will soon someday buy into what you've come up with. I really liked your quote by Max Planck, who was the founder of quantum mechanics, who said that old scientists never change their mind. They just die, and new scientists accept new concepts of their merits. And maybe that's how things get accepted.
Well, I can show you some of the pictures of this. I have a film coming out at the end of the year called Third Eye Spies, dealing with these CIA people that we worked with during the Cold War. And if you want to see me and the people I work with, we have a website called thirdeyespies.com. And there's a very nice four-minute coming attraction that shows you a lot of the work that I've just described.
And you've got a movie coming out, a film coming out.
Yeah, the movie is called Third Eye Spies.
Okay, and that's going to be...
And you can see the coming attraction. And I have a website called espresearch.com. So if you go to my website, ESP Research, you'll find a lot of the books we've talked about, and you'll find a link to the movie.
Okay, and the movie will be released, the formal movie will be released sometime around the end of the year, is that correct?
That's right.
Okay. And you've written a book which I highly recommend. It's a very interesting book, The Reality of ESP by Russell Targ. Russell, thank you so much for being here. It's been great fun chatting with you.
Thank you very much for the opportunity. I'm glad to chat with you.
It was great. Obtaining wisdom is a long process, as no one can bestow it on us. The more we talk and hear each other's ideas, the more we'll be able to mature our own views. Question and answers from the chat room for today's show and other shows will be posted on my website at davidgagan.com. You can ask other questions directly by going to the contact section of my website, and I'll publish those answers as well. Also, I cover all of these subjects and many more in my book, The Endless Journey. I look forward to sharing our thoughts every Friday morning at 9 a.m. United States Eastern Time here on W4CY.com. You can also find all the old episodes on iHeartRadio at iHeart.com. Truth is indeed stranger than fiction, and it turns out to be an amazingly good news story. We all have a great destiny ahead of us. Let me leave you with one last thought. You are a unique spirit having a life experience. You are far more important in the grander scheme of things than you can possibly realize. Enjoy your life. You've earned it.